Welcome you. It's 2:30 in the afternoon. We announced for 2:30. We've got Senator Walker here. Thank you, Senator Walker, for coming. We're going to start with Senate Bill 718, as they engrossed. This bill directs members of the Oregon Investment Council to declare conflicts of interest in writing no later than 3 days after discovering a conflict. Mazin, anything you'd like to add there?
The only thing, Mr. Chair and members
of
the committee,
come forward, Senator. Thank you very much. You've honored us by coming.
As the bill comes to you as engrossed, the amendments that the bill went through in the beginning have went from 1 day to 3 days, three business days after discovering the conflict. And the second thing, which is still miswritten on your SMS, is the fine to be $250 rather than $1,000 when failure to observe that time happens.
But they didn't figure any of them had $1,000? Is that problem?
Well, I think there was a concern that many of these people are in the voluntary kind of things, and they don't know, so that was some level of compromise on it. The just a quick thing, the council consists out of 6 members. The governor appoints 4 of these. The 5th is by default the state treasurer. And the 6th is a non-voting ex officio members, who's the, of course, the PERS director. And this bill deals differently from what the statutes are of conflict of interest. This precisely deals with potential conflict of interest.
Okay.
But knowing the potential. So that's the nuance that needs to be.
I understand that there's some concern about finding a member that would could serve on the Oregon Investment Council as well as the PERS as a non-voting ex officio person, so far as time-wise, and that's probably something we probably need to address in this process, finding that person at the dedicated time. Questions of staff? Thank you, Senator Walker. We're honored by your attendance here today. Please proceed. We are on Senate Bill 718 as they engrossed. This is your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I invite Kate Richardson from the Treasurer's
Office? You bet. Please invite Kate up. She's the other person that signed up here.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear before your committee today. And Ms. Richardson and I worked out some of the issues, well, actually all of our issues, on the Senate side before we sent it over to you. Let me just explain the background for this bill, and the Treasurer had the same thing in mind as I did, only my bill beat him to the punch. So we got mine filed. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you. It arises out of the Diana Goldschmidt case on the Oregon Investment Council and the Texas Pacific Group mess. On October 29th, the council had a meeting, and they voted to, at that time, they passed a motion to unanimously granting the subcommittee authorization to consider a $300 million investment in Fund 4 of TPG at its subcommittee meeting of November 10th. And that was exceeding the $200 million limit that was established in policy. That very day, Ms. Goldschmidt got in the car with her husband, rode to the airport. They flew down to San Francisco, I believe, where he actually met with Texas Pacific Group folks. And his intent in San Francisco was to take his wife for a birthday. But TPG found out about it. They flew out there and they met with him. So Ms. Goldschmidt became aware the next day that there was a potential conflict of interest because her husband was being courted for this position on Texas Pacific Group. Yet Ms. Goldschmidt failed to give any notice to the Oregon Investment Council or its chair. I believe Mr. Bidwell was in the car with her, and he knew about it, but no one bothered to notify the rest of the council. So this became a very black stain on the process. I believe the subcommittee may have reconsidered whether to continue with that vote on November 10th, had it known, and then Ms. Goldschmidt did not allow the tell the rest of the council that she was going to abstain until November 19th. So this bill came about as a precaution that we need to know immediately if, and immediately became 3 days. It was 1 day in my original bill, and the treasurer asked for 3 days to allow a little more time. So this states in statute now that the council will know within 3 days if there's a potential, if a potential conflict of interest. And the fee was dropped from $1,000 down to $250. Senator Decker, the chair of the Senate Revenue Committee, was a little concerned about that fine, that there is a, the fine does not change for an actual violation of the potential conflict of interest, but it, we, I wanted something in there to smack somebody's hand for not doing it right. And, Mr. Chair, this is important because we are dealing with a council that deals with billions of dollars in state assets and investments, and they need to be above reproach, and we will talk a little bit about that in Senate Bill 302 if you get to that today as well.
Okay. Kate, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kate Richardson, Oregon State Treasury. The treasurer did bring forth a bill that addressed the issue that Senator Walker described. An actual or a potential conflict of interest apparently does not exist until there's, in fact, a vote in front of the council. So although there's already in statute a requirement to disclose an, a potential or actual conflict of interest, there really was no obligation to do that until there was a vote, until the moment of the vote. So in this situation, or situations like this, the language that you'll see in your bill there on line 17 is becomes aware of the possibility of an actual or potential conflict. So it's one step removed, and that is, for instance, the situation that Senator Walker described is that you know the member would know or have a pretty good idea that should a vote, you know, there's a something pending before the council or we're in business with a particular manager, for instance, and that situation might arise where should there be a vote regarding that manager or that investment, the member would be obliged to declare an actual or potential. It's just an extra layer of disclosure. And
these are all public meetings, Kate?
These are all public meetings. This would be
what of meetings to meet with counsel that might be covered by the executive meeting statutes behind closed doors. Can we assume that you could have someone who could be in potential direct violation of this for up to 3 days involved in face-to-face negotiations for 3 days?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I understand your question correctly, this is only if there is a possibility of an actual potential conflict. If there is an actual potential conflict, there's already existing statute that requires that disclosure.
I see.
So this bill would just require a written notification to the treasurer just so that we're aware. If we are in negotiations, then we are made aware of that.
Certainly.
If there's something coming down the pike. In the treasurer's bill, there was not a civil penalty attached. In the current statute, for non-disclosure of an actual or failure to disclose an actual potential conflict of interest, which this applies to you or and other public officials, there is a civil penalty there. Because this is a much more attenuated situation, the treasurer did not feel it needed to rise to the level of a civil penalty.
I see. But there is a $250 penalty for failure to disclose that within the 3 days.
Mr. Chair, that was a component of Senator Walker's bill. It originally, as she mentioned, it was higher. We did not feel it. It was the same, should be the same level of penalty.
And the issue of the member, the non-voting member of the OIC, including one ex-officio member non-voting of the PERS, are these folks, do we have a lot of those around that?
Mr. Chair, I think There's two different situations related to the PERS. There is the ex officio non-voting member, the sixth member of the OIC Council, or OIC, and that is the director of the PERS system, and that's been in place, and that's not an issue. In prior statute, actually before the PERS reforms of last session, and then to go into effect, I think in 2007, there is also a crossover member between the PERS board. Mm-hmm. And that is that would be a voting member.
Right.
So it would be a crossover member from the PERS board and the Oregon Investment Council.
Does such a person exist today on either the PERS or the OIC? Do they, do we have one that has enough time to do both?
Well, in prior, under the former PERS board, which was a different structure, there was, and that was in statute, and currently on our council, Mark Gardner, who used to be on the prior PERS board, is serving on our council. So there's a little bit of that, but he's not serving on both.
Right.
The governor's office has expressed a concern to us that because the PERS board has been restructured to be smaller but also more time-consuming, and then, of course, our investment council is small as well and meets regularly and considering takes a considerable amount of time, that does narrow the pool of people who would be willing to do both.
Okay. Questions of either of these two folks, Senator Walker and Kate Richardson? I just want to make sure, let's see, the it's a potential, a member becomes aware of the possibility of an actual or potential conflict. And so previously, if they actually did have a conflict, the statute is there to cover those issues. Is that right?
Okay. That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate this information. Colleagues, any questions that we have amongst ourselves relative to the 3 business days, reducing the penalty to $250. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 718A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 718A. President Kump.
Chairman Butler, I move Senate Bill 718 with a due pass recommendation to the floor.
You've heard the motion to the discussion relative to the motion. Hearing and seeing none, is there any objections to moving this to the floor of the due pass recommendation in accordance with the motion? Hearing and seeing none, and for the record, we have all House members present. There being no objections, so ordered. This has been an issue of some degree of contention, so however, I would be willing to put it on the consent, but I'm anxious for it was amended.
Mm-hmm. I'm not in favor of the consent calendar.
Okay, all right. So we've got some opposition to the consent calendar. Who would like to carry this bill then?
Well, if he objects to it, let him know.
I'll carry this bill before.
I can do it, sir.
Okay, Representative Esquivel. Representative Esquivel will move this bill before and carry it on the floor. With that, we will close the work session on 718A. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 302. Is that the next one? Yep. This was Peter, next is Paul, and then Mary. Is that right? Mazin? Change your name. Breaking up a perfectly good trio.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 302A comes to you from Senator Walker through the Senate Revenue Committee. It does two things in terms of the Oregon Investment Council and the terms of members. If you look on page 2, line 16, it amends the current statute to say that an appointed member may not be appointed to more than 2 full terms in any 12-year period. So it limits members on the Oregon Investment Council to 2 terms. And then under Section 3 there's a new sub 3 that a person may not serve as chairperson of the council for more than 4 years in any 12-year period. So the chairperson can only serve 4 years during that period. And that Senate Revenue Committee discussed both those issues at length. There's a new Section 5 there that requires full sound recordings of OIC meetings, and that's, again, a new section proposed to the statute. The one amendment that was made in Senate Revenue was the original bill did require monthly meetings, and that was deleted from the bill, and that's why it's an A in gross.
So it's just a regular scheduled meetings is what the statute would provide them. Okay. Representative Walker, Senator Walker, I beg your pardon. Thank you again for coming. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm delighted. Once again, Vicki Walker, Senate District 7. This is the second of my two-part good government bills related to the Oregon Investment Council. Let me start out with the last part, the new section, Section 5, requiring sound recordings. The October 29th meeting that I spoke about was an off-site meeting for the board. It wasn't noticed as a regular meeting. It was a work session or a training session. Kate can correct me if I'm wrong, but there were no recordings made of that meeting. And Mr. Chair, as I indicated, this council works with billions of state dollars, so it's really critical that we have recordings of all our meetings, just like we do here in the Capitol. I also ask that minutes be prepared, like we do have here in the Capitol, and those are accessible through the state archives. I've become sort of a budding archivist. I find that there is a lot of information in the state archives building, and I plowed through the files of the Oregon Investment Council dating back several years looking for information that I needed. And, Mr. Chair, one of the things that I found is that the Oregon Investment Council created on its own a standard of ethics, and I believe that came under the tenure of Treasurer Bill Rutherford, because he contacted me by telephone one day. The standard of ethics lists a number of things that the investment council believes that they need to adhere to, and one of the things that they talk about in their standard are the appointments. And they indicate that no person shall be eligible to serve as a member of the council for more than two terms in any period of 12 years, and that a person shall not serve as chair for more than 4 years in a 12-year period. But the interesting thing about these standard of ethics, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is that the council gives themselves an out. Number five says waivers of certain standard of ethics. The council, upon voting majority of its members, may waive its own standards through sections 2 through 4, which includes the service of the membership on the council. The waiver granted by the council shall be in writing and shall be filed with the state treasurer and the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission. Well, I believe that those that the terms of the chair has been violated, the current chair, and I've never gotten a definitive ruling from the Department of Justice, but the current chair, Gerard Jummond, I believe has served more than his 4-year term in the 12-year period. I contacted the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission and asked if there had ever been anything filed in writing showing that there had been a waiver of that term. The answer was, we have no jurisdiction over the Oregon Investment Council. We would never have accepted anything in writing. I then asked the state treasurer's office if they had anything in writing, and Ms. Richardson informed me that the council, by its own vote, would have voted to overturn their provisions in the standard of ethics, or that the governor, by his appointment, would have done that. Because, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would let you know that Mr. Drummond was brought back to serve on the investment council by Governor Kitzhaber. And his understanding, and I have the letter that I found in the state archives, Mr. Drummond's understanding was that when he came back to serve on the investment council, he would be serving as chair. And that was the only way he was coming back to serve on the council. So the governor reappointed him, and he serves as chair, and I continue to object to that service, not necessarily that he's a bad member, but just that he's serving in violation of what I believe to be the standard of ethics. So again, I would say the Department of Justice has never yet answered that question, and Ms. Richardson probably has a different view. But be that as it may, Mr. Chair, the standard of ethics were implemented because we need accountability and transparency. So I wanted to put them in statute to make sure the council could not overturn their own standard of ethics. And that's why I have this bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Kate.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kate Richardson, Oregon State Treasury. First, to just address the issue of the October 29th meeting that was referenced by Senator Walker. That was a public meeting, and it was noticed accordingly. It was an off-site workshop meeting with no initial business planned at that time. There was notice.
Where was the meeting, Kate?
It was at the River Place Alexis Hotel in downtown Portland. It was a workshop meeting. There wasn't sound recording for it. There's not a requirement in public meetings that you have to have a sound recording. We do record all of our OIC meetings. This was an off-site one. There's not a statute addressing that. Well, you do have to keep minutes, and there were minutes kept at that meeting. Regardless, it's our policy to record all of our meetings.
So there's no additional fiscal for doing this the way that you have done in the past?
No.
All right.
To the issue of our policy, the standard of ethics that Senator Walker referenced, that there is one of the Oregon Investment Council's policies. Does include some of the provisions that she addressed here regarding appointments. Now, as you know, statutes always trump a policy, and the OIC appointment is the prerogative of the governor. So although there is this policy regarding the service of an OIC member, it's always the governor's prerogative to address or to appoint. So that provision couldn't be put in place if an OIC member was reappointed by the governor within that certain length of time. So that's one issue there. Regarding the chairship, that is the prerogative of the Oregon Investment Council, and the council votes on that. However, there is a provision here that would allow waiver of that policy. Again, looking to the situation, it's a small council, hard sometimes to find service among the experienced service, and so there may be a situation that the council thought it would be better to have a more experienced chair or a particular person in that chairship. And so this is, again, a policy as a guideline here, and it was put in place. But regarding the appointments or the service on the council and also the chairship, waiver of those didn't pose a threat to the ethics, and so that's why we have it in policy. As to this bill, we did not actively oppose it in the other chamber. We don't think it's necessary because the policies are in place, and again, it's an encroachment on the governor more than on the council itself, because it would limit the governor's appointment to OIC members. I will say it is a council that requires a fair amount of expertise and time. And I'll leave it there.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One issue, I guess, is that this is just about length of time and the length of service. And personally, I don't see how that has anything to do with ethics. But that aside, I'm not comfortable in imposing statute on who the governor can appoint to this board.
Further questions of these folks? I guess Kate, my response to wanting senior people to chair the council, it seems like to me that either you're having other council members return at later times, which I understand that's happened, but certainly a person could have been there for a period of 6 years before they're called to be a chair for 2 years or for 4 years. I guess it couldn't be a chair for 4 years at that point if they served 6 years. But maybe it's a good idea to turn the chairs over on a more frequent basis rather than having a king for a day when somebody says, I won't serve unless you make me chair. Maybe I'm misreading the understanding.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to that point, the council voted who was the chair. And that is still that's actually in statute.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. I found the letter I was speaking of that I found in the archives. It's dated April 20th, 2001, addressed to Governor Kitzhaber from Mr. Drummond. And he says, I am writing this following our telephone conversation today, during which you expressed your desire that I return to the Oregon Investment Council as its chair. Based on that conversation, is my expectation to be appointed to the council effective June 1, 2001, assuming confirmation, and by that time, you will have talked to those members of the council with whom you have not already discussed my return to the OIC as chair. He was serving as the on the Port of Portland at the time. The governor asked him to come back and serve as chair of the OIC. I would also like to let the committee know that in its history, the Oregon Investment Council, there was a gentleman who served as chair for a number of years, Roger Meyer, I believe is his name. And I believe he served for an awfully long time, like 12 years, 8 years, a significant period of time. And during that time period, there was quite a scandal in the treasurer's office. Tony Meeker was the treasurer at the time. There were some very poor investments made by the council. Now, I have to remind you, the council, I believe, is ranked in the top 5% of investment returns, but there were investments made by the council that they're still dealing with today. There's a little hangar out there at the Port of Portland.
Oh, yes, the famous hangar at Port of Portland.
That I would, yes, Mr. Chair, I would bring that to your attention. So it is important that these council chairs not be entrenched, so much so that they become king for a great deal of time. So I really think that's why this bill is necessary. And I don't think anyone should be able to trump that,
yes,
a governor or a council.
Certainly sounds like this bill would eliminate these kinds of invitations and representations being made. You wonder how independent independently the board serves at that particular point when the governor can dictate policy by visiting with the members and bending their arms. So I'm anxious that we at least give the appearance of a standard of ethics at that point. Further discussion? Representative Riley?
Mr. Chair, I have to say that I still don't see what length of service has to do with ethics, and I do see what experience has to do with doing a good job. And if they're in the top 5%, I think that sounds pretty good. Also, Mr. Chair, I believe that, you know, it's not uncommon in this body to have the members have their arms twisted by people in the leadership.
Okay. Never had that happen too many times.
From your guys' experience.
Well, I would say this. I think experience is very, very important in this regard, but I'm also anxious that this be above board as opposed to being something that's not open. Again, if the standard of ethics was that the board was to select its own leadership, then you wouldn't think that the governor should be involved. And I would say this with regard to the returns on the state's capital. I think that behind the scenes, the secretary or the treasurer of the state has a very excellent staff who do an excellent job and has had for the several terms that I've been involved in state government, has had some very excellent staff, and they do an excellent job in making those investment decisions. And while I recognize that the input of the Oregon Investment Council members is extremely important, I also want to recognize the caliber of men and women that we have serving both as the treasurer of the state as well as his staff. Further discussion? Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Walker, would you mind sharing a copy of that letter from Governor Kitzhaber with the committee?
I'd be happy to. Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Boquist.
Follow-up, Representative Boquist.
In a follow-up, just so the your bill that came out of the Senate really doesn't change the training requirements or the experience or anything along that line. I see we're really talking about the terms that we have, and correct me if I'm wrong, either from the Treasury Department or from the good senator. I mean, I know enough about investment that being involved closely with the investment community is what brings you that experience. And I think it was raised that these members spend a considerable amount of time on the investment council. And so it would seem logical to bring, for better word, fresh faces on a routine basis who are experienced from the private sector to it also. Does that seem to make sense and part of the intent of your bill, Senator?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, my intent of the bill was to honor the standard of ethics that the council crafted for itself. They thought it was important enough to rotate the chair position and to limit the terms of members. So I'm just putting that in statute because I think that was probably a good idea. It keeps the council above reproach, make sure they have experienced people serving in those positions. I don't think the council has ever lack for good people to put on the council with experience that I recall.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, if I may address Representative Bradley's point. This section, this policy number, has a title of Standard of Ethics. I would agree with Representative Riley's point that some of the things in here may not really address ethics. Much of this policy does address disclosure and other points of view. The terms, the section regarding the term is in there as an expression, but recognizing it's the governor's prerogative and the council members serve at the pleasure of the governor.
And certainly that's true, but if it is, Kate, that the expression that they serve at the direction of the governor and that they choose their own leadership, it appears that the choosing your own leadership may have been circumvented by at least a prior governor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the council members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. The document, I guess, speaks for itself. There was a vote of the council, and anytime there is a change of the chairship, there is a vote of the council.
Okay. Further discussion? Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Walker, for taking time out of your busy schedule. Kate, we're always glad to see you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will.
Go ahead.
I will go back to my office and have my staff make copies of this letter and bring it right down.
Please, please do that. Thank you very much. We will go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 302 as A engrossed. Representative Comp.
Chairman Butler, I move that Senate Bill.
Oh, wait a minute. Did I open a work session on 302 as engrossed? Representative Comp.
I move that Senate Bill 302 A engrossed be moved to the floor with a due pass.
You've heard the motion that 302 A engrossed be moved to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Boquist?
I have no problem with it, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that the letter that the good senator is made a part of the official record.
You bet. We will do that. That's certainly a reasonable request, and I think it demonstrates the reason for this particular bill. Further discussion. Is there any objection to moving this in accordance with the recommendation? Representative Riley objects. Why don't we go ahead and take a roll, an oral roll, please, so that no one will contend that they were twisted, their arms were twisted by the vote.
Representative Boquist.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Felicio?
Aye.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
No.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair House?
Aye.
Chair Butler?
Butler votes aye. With that, House or Senate Bill 302A engrossed, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed to the House of the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Esquivel, will you carry that one as well?
Glad to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very kindly. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 302A and open the public hearing on Senate Bill, Senate Bill 839A. Let's see, we're getting Mary up here, the third of our Naz and Paul and Mary.
It's a new group.
It's a new group. Welcome, Mary, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 839A engrossed, and the bill extends the sunset provision from January 2006 to 2012 for current law. Current law allows cities and counties to pass ordinances that will provide property tax exemptions to owners of multifamily units if the units are located in either light rail station areas, transit-oriented areas, or the units, which must be located in designated core areas of a city or county, are affordable to houses that satisfy low-income requirements. The exemption for each property that does not include land is limited to 10 years. The average, the original Senate bill had a 10-year exemption to 2016, and that is why it's an A in growth bill. The municipalities of Portland, Gresham, and Eugene have active programs for qualified multifamily rental units, and Salem has active programs, but the exemptions expired last year. And the revenue impact associated with this particular proposal is $0.31 million for the 05-07 biennium, $2.7 for the subsequent biennium.
Okay, and that revenue impact is as to all local government revenue impact, including schools.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions of staff? Representative Berger is recognized.
Yeah, Mary, can you explain to me why the Salem exemptions expired last year? Was it in relation to what the programs were?
They have active programs, but the exemption lasts 10 years. So these buildings are still constructed and they're still operating, so to speak.
But it was a 10-year limit, yes, on the exemption. And
correct.
And so they're... And then to this, would the exemptions then...
This is just an extended sunset provision so that new proposals can be considered.
So it won't impact those that are
no.
in Salem. Okay, thank you.
So that Salem will be extended under this as well.
The existing exemptions under those programs that they have that are active, they only have a 10-year exemption period. But it doesn't prohibit the city of Salem from considering new proposals.
The ones that are in that are done, but new ones would come in.
That is correct.
And they would only be available through 2012 under this.
Under this proposal, it will be 2012.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Provision.
Okay. Let's see. We have Representative Farr. Representative Farr, thank you for coming. We're honored to have you take time from your busy schedule and be with us. Is there someone that you'd like to bring up with you?
Yes, I would, Chair Butler. In fact, I'm going to make my comments very brief. For the record, my name is Debbie Farr, State Representative, District 14. Chair Butler and committee, I was asked to sponsor this bill, this House bill, and Ryan Deckert sponsored the same bill on the Senate side, passed through the Senate, and that's why it's here before you. And I asked the good senator if I could sign on the bill with him, and he graciously allowed me to do so. So since you all hear from me regularly and you're probably bored with the sound of my voice, I...
Yeah.
I would like to invite Richie Weinman from the City of Eugene and Hugh Pritchard, who is a Eugene developer, to give testimony. But I just want to say that the multi-unit property tax exemption has done some really great things to revitalize Eugene's downtown. Broadway Place is one of those examples, one of my favorite places to have lunch and a quick bite to eat in the evening. Three of Eugene's best eateries that wouldn't have existed if not for the big high-rise and parking garage that... And when I say high-rise in Eugene, you have to understand what that means. I'm going to let the two next to me explain. But by Eugene standards, it would be considered a high-rise. But a very good use of space and really does benefit the community.
And those are located next to the transit-oriented areas?
Within easy walking distance.
And that is how far, for instance?
Well, it's in the downtown core.
Okay. For the record, you are?
I'm Richie Weinman. I'm with the City of Eugene.
Thank
I'm
you.
I'm services manager.
Thank you.
Yeah. You want to give your name? Yeah.
Hugh Pritchard. I'm a co-developer of Broadway Place.
Okay.
So why don't I start with some brief remarks and then it works for you.
Right.
So, the City of Eugene really is a strong promoter of smart growth, and we encourage housing in our core area. And in last year's updated downtown plan, and also in our local amended ordinance that enables these property tax exemptions, we've been very aggressive about trying to create more housing in the downtown area. And this bill supports our overall land use goals and our adopted plan to invigorate downtown. and encourage alternative modes of transportation. And there are very few tools available to do this, and this is one of them. It's more expensive to build in a downtown than it is to build on the edges. And this bill is simply enabling legislation. A city doesn't have to participate, but Eugene does because we're trying to encourage that. And I might add that the school district has strongly supported this. They recognize the value in the long run of more downtown housing and increased investment in the core. We're convinced as a city that the impact of this program is much more about benefiting the community and less about benefiting any particular private developers. I think Mr. Pritchard can talk about that some, but we don't believe that these projects would happen without the incentive. They just wouldn't happen at all, and so it's really a good deal for us. The developer has to demonstrate to us that the project wouldn't happen but for the exemption, and we're not really foregoing revenue. We're just putting off revenue we wouldn't have otherwise gotten in the short term in terms of a windfall 10 years down the road, and we're okay with doing that. We haven't done that many of these. Over the last 25 years, we've only done a dozen. But we did a moratorium on them after Measure 47 and 50 passed. And right before that, we had had a couple of applications. During that period of time, there was virtually no construction of multifamily housing in the core area. As soon as we lifted the moratorium last year, or actually 2003, we started getting applications again. So that proved to us that the program made a difference, because without it, we simply didn't get any multifamily housing built in that area. So that's all I'm going to say for now. You might have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard.
Thank you. I wanted to address, I appreciated Representative Berger saying that the ones that are done are done, because I want to talk about one that's done and indicate how they're never quite done. The multi-unit property tax exemption does have a very transparent process for getting it granted, and that is in a public work session, developer has to present two pro formas, one if they were paying real estate taxes and one if they're not. And it's a good process.
You had previously identified yourself, Mr. Pritchard. Can you do it again, please?
Oh, Hugh Pritchard, co-developer of Broadway Place.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you. In the case of Broadway Place, the process there is key, because we felt that we could not build it paying property taxes, so we were very discouraged. The process encouraged us to look at it very hard if we weren't paying property taxes on the housing. We do pay it on the retail portion. So we managed to talk ourselves into it through this process and built the project. We projected that the rate of return on the project would be 9%, which in real estate land is not particularly high return, but it was one that would work for us. The return to date, 5 years after it's open, last year was 5% on the equity invested. And the interesting thing here is that we 5% on $3 million that we invested as equity is $140,000. That was our net cash flow for the year. Property taxes would have been, we estimate, around $175,000 at this point. So the property would have lost money in this, its fifth year. It would have lost money in the previous four. As you probably know, you can't tolerate losses like that for a long time. And so the great thing about this exemption is it encouraged us to build a project that we would previously said we can't quite make it. Even though it's not up to the level we would like it to be financially, it's a very successful project. Our investors are happy, we're happy, and I think downtown Eugene benefits greatly. It's the largest project that's been built outside of the metro area of Portland that is a mixed-use downtown project. It's 170 units on street-side retail and office, and built on top of 750 parking garage stalls that the city built in before we built on top of them. So it drove a very progressive project, a dense project, one that really affects the fabric of downtown Eugene. We would not have built it without the encouragement of this exemption and the process that drove us through the exemption. So I just wanted to present that personal story to you that might get left out of just reading what's in front of you. And I'd take any questions.
The total elevation of this, you've got a parking garage and downtown commercial and then apartments up above?
Right. It's two stories above parking, and the parking is about 16 feet above the ground. So it's probably about a 30-foot high rise. But
the parking's underground.
Parking is partially underground, partially above ground. So the entire structure is something like 30 feet high. So, Debbie, well, so it's a high rise, yes.
So it's, what is it? Is it actually three stories?
From the street, you perceive it to be maybe 2.5 stories.
Okay.
And it is, as a design aside, we visited a lot of these places in this country, and I also was in England at that time, and found that the ones that were four stories seemed to be too big. They seemed to be imposing on the street and so forth. So we liked this size. The other thing that you don't need to know about the project is it's on both sides of the street for a full city block, so it creates its own neighborhood facing itself.
I see.
And the parking, you can't perceive the parking on the street front. You have to go around to the side streets to enter or leave the parking garages. So it really created a little village, a very dense little urban village there.
With commercial on the ground floor and then the apartments up above.
Right, and three restaurants and the rest office at this point.
I see. I see. That's excellent. Questions of these three folks? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Debbie, or Representative Ford, do you have anything more that you want to do?
No, thank you. This is good for Eugene. Good bill.
Thank you. And 30 feet high is a high rise in Ontario, too. question of staff. Let's see. Well, while we're doing that, we've got Barbara Sack from Portland, John Warner from Portland, and Randy Tucker from Portland.
We've morphed.
Well, I guess you have. Randy, you've changed. Okay. Randy Tucker's left his testimony.
Do some work there, Robert. Take
one faster than
that.
For me.
Yes, go ahead with your question, please.
Mary, just so I understand this, what exactly we're doing here, the exemption from property taxes under this program is 10 years long for anybody who qualifies.
Correct.
What we're doing here is reauthorizing this program until 2012.
Correct.
Okay. It's a little confusing. I just want to make that clear.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Marge Kafori, representing the City of Portland. With me is Barbara Sack, who is with the Planning Bureau of the City of Portland, and Dennis Mulvihill from Washington County. Washington County requested introduction of this bill on the Senate side. Vice Chair Berger, you are absolutely correct. That's exactly what the bill does. Even if someone applies for a property tax exemption in year five of the program, the person is eligible for the 10-year abatement. Right. You're receiving two documents from the City of Portland. One is Ms. Sack's testimony. She will be briefly going through that with you in just a moment. The other one over my letterhead is a brief description of what a city does if it's going to activate this program or continue using the program, and the steps that we go through to qualify a developer or an applicant for eligibility for the property tax abatement, except for the land. A developer has to pass what we call the but-for test, which means that but for the property tax abatement, the project would not go forward. So this is a pretty strong standard. We don't just give property tax abatements to anybody that comes in and wants one. In exchange, the developer offers certain things that are public benefits that go along with getting the property tax exemption, such as reduction in rents that they offer to their tenants, limited rates of return to the developer of maybe 10 or 12% a year. In other words, they can't just get the property tax abatement and walk off with a substantial amount of profit every year. Or the provision of public art, landscaping, other public amenities that would be available to the general public at large through the property. It's an important aspect of what we are doing to try to stimulate affordable housing in the core areas of the city and housing along our light rail and streetcar lines. And as you know, we've invested heavily in those streetcar lines and light rail stations along in our community. And we use this tool to create density of housing and commercial areas around those light rail lanes. So with that, unless you have any questions of me, Barbara Sack is ready to walk through this program briefly.
Thank you, Ms. Corey. Do you need to leave?
No.
Oh, okay. Fine. Let's go to Ms. Sack.
My name is Barbara Sack. I'm with the City of Portland Planning Bureau, and we have two multifamily housing programs that are authorized by these statutes, and I was just going to talk a little bit about the background of these programs and some of the benefits that we see coming out of them. As Mary has said, the property tax exemption is for the improvements only. A piece of property that's built on the land still is paying property taxes to the city. There's an economic feasibility test. Our Portland Development Commission decides, makes a decision about whether a project needs the tax exemption to go forward or not. We also have John Warner here from the Portland Development Commission if anybody would like any details on the financial aspects of these programs. But most importantly, we would ask that some public benefits be provided by the developer in return for the tax exemption. And these can include affordable housing units, transit amenities, dedications for public use. Our Planning Commission and City Council has to make a ruling that the public benefits provided by these various projects do justify the tax exemption. So I just wanted to sort of reinforce those things. Now, as I said, the City of Portland has two programs. The first program was developed in 1975. This is a program for our core area. In the 1970s, the city of Portland, downtown Portland, was in kind of bad shape. It had lost almost half its housing units between 1950 and 1970. Businesses were suffering because of the competition from suburban shopping malls, and the air quality was very bad. At that time, there was a land use plan done called the Downtown Plan of 1972, and one of the strategies set out in that plan was to get more housing in the downtown to help solve these problems, the air quality problem, the business problem, and also there were a lot of people that needed housing downtown. Not everybody is able to use an automobile or afford an automobile. So in 1975, the City of Portland adopted this program as a revitalization strategy. And since that time, it has proved very successful. Under this program, 5,000 housing units have been built in about 40 projects. The majority of these are rentals. And this new housing in the downtown provides people an opportunity to live without an automobile, to live close to work, or if you're elderly, to live close to services. And it's been a very successful program as far as we're concerned. It's also led to the construction of fairly substantial projects, and of course the tax exemption only lasts 10 years. So when these projects go back on the rolls, you know, they have added to the revenues of the city. In 1995, the legislature allowed these programs to also be used in light rail station areas. So the city created a separate program for light rail stations, although it has similar requirements to our downtown program. And this program has also gotten a lot of use. It's used at the Gateway Regional Center, which is on the light rail line, and will be the point at which two light rail lines will cross when the light rail down I-205 is built. It's been used in the Hollywood Town Center, and it's also been used at Northeast 60th and Gleason. So having this housing development around these light rail stations supports ridership for the light rail, and it allows people to live a lifestyle where they don't need to use their car as much. Now, if any of you have driven through downtown Portland or been on I-5 around rush hour, I mean, you know what the traffic's like. Back in the 80s, the city of Portland decided that the way we're going to address the traffic problem and also the air pollution problem is to build a light rail system. And this program, by providing for denser housing around light rail stations, will help us with our air pollution and traffic congestion. Building more freeways, would lead to the destruction of neighborhoods in Portland. And so this helps support our preferred alternative. So I've mentioned the public benefit in terms of supporting transit. Also, having these programs helps us deal with growth management. As you know, the metropolitan Portland area is projected to grow for the next, in the foreseeable future. And one way of absorbing population growth is to build denser housing, particularly in the central city. This relieves the pressure to expand the urban growth boundary at the edges of the city, and when you expand that urban growth boundary, you're expanding it onto frequently forest and farmland. So this this program, although it wasn't originally adopted as a growth management tool, now one of its greatest usefulnesses to the city is to provide growth management, because by creating an incentive to develop high-density housing in these areas in Portland's central city, particularly in these areas that were formerly industrial brownfields like South Waterfront and the River District, this is the place for us to house our increasing population, since the people that live in the downtown are close to work, or if they work in the Sunset Corridor, they can take the light rail. This helps relieve traffic congestion while at the same time allows us to grow population-wise. And lastly, these programs have provided low, moderate, and middle-income housing units in the downtown. What's happening right now is living downtown has become quite popular, and also it's become increasingly popular in the Lloyd Center and Gateway and the Hollywood District. But what the market tends to build is high-end condominium units, or you have low-income housing built because there's subsidies available, like low-income housing tax credits. So this program helps provide an incentive for middle-income housing. It's been used to help be an additional subsidy with some low-income housing projects, but it also helps provide what we call workforce housing. So this has been another big benefit of the program. So in short, we've found this to be a useful and successful program, and we would like to see the sunset date extended.
Thank you very much, Barbara. Dennis?
Good afternoon. Dennis Smallbottle, Washington County. Washington County wants to add its voice to the chorus of folks that support this exemption. Washington County has not used this, but it is our feeling that we will likely want to use it, or at least have it available on the commuter rail corridor that will be running here in a few years. I think that the Washington County Board of Commissioners would probably, I would describe it as be hard-nosed about whether or not you give it away or not. If it's not going to be needed to get something to happen, we won't use it. And I would use it as an example, is that this was available on the West Side Light Rail, and we didn't use it there. Wasn't needed. Little different thing going on with the commuter rail, and we'd like to have this available in case we need to take it off, but it isn't necessarily going to be used. But if it is, we don't want to miss an opportunity.
Dennis, do you charge a fee in Washington County similar to the $5,000 that's charged in Portland?
Mr. Chairman, I do not know the answer to that question, because I don't even know if they're that far along.
Okay. And what constitutes a high rise of the magnitude that you're talking about, Barbara and Marge? How many stories are we talking about?
To use this program, you have to have a multifamily project that has 10 units. There's no height or bulk requirements other than that.
Well, the reason I ask that is that we're being told in Eastern Oregon that we've got to start building up instead of building out. So I just wondered, I'm not sure how you get your cattle to market. We don't use the light rail. So I just wondered what constituted the high rise.
Mr. Chairman, I happen to be living in one, and it is 16 stories tall.
Is that parking?
That includes three stories of parking above ground.
And then easy access to the rail line?
I live on the streetcar line. It brackets my high rise.
Excellent. And
the project I'm living in was not built using this particular program.
Okay. But the ground floor is commercial, is it?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Great. And that does provide sufficient parking for all of the people who live in the building?
Most of the units, Mr. Chair, are limited to one parking place.
I see.
It depends on the size of the unit.
But not for parking for the commercial businesses?
Mr. Chair, there is, about a block and a half away from where I live, a 1,200 space below ground parking lot for serving the commercial areas adjacent to that building.
We call that a landfill in Eastern Oregon. Okay, other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned middle-income housing. Could you define what's the cost of one of these units on average? I think you said you built 5,000 or something, but what's the present cost to build a single unit cost of one of these multiple housing units?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
We do have a developer here.
John might know the answer to that.
John, you're signed up.
Wait.
Help us out here.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm John Warner with the Portland Development Commission. I think the per-unit production costs for the multifamily housing that we're talking about can vary depending upon the size of the unit and the density of the development. In response, to your question a moment ago, I think much of the development we see is five stories at most, but occasionally, especially in the downtown area, we'll have projects that are in excess of that. When you get above 10 stories, you're getting into true high-rise construction codes, which make the units much more expensive to produce. Currently, I'm looking at a project that would be a 26-story building, which would be pushing the envelope on that. The production costs for construction hard costs on that building are approximately $140 per square foot. Now, depending upon whether you're talking about a studio unit or a two-bedroom unit, those units can vary substantially in terms of their total development costs. But production costs for denser transit-oriented development are significant when you have to include the cost of structured parking plus the life safety requirements to make sure that those are safe places to live, and dealing with the fact that in Portland in particular we have seismic issues as well to make sure the buildings would be able to withstand an earthquake. Our construction costs can be significant. I'm thinking on average I would say about $135,000 to $145,000 total development cost per dwelling unit would be what I would suggest would be typical.
So, and those are rental apartments, is that there?
Correct.
And that, does that 135, 145 include the parking space for the automobile?
It would. It would be the total development cost of the project divided by the number of units in it.
Okay. All right, Representative Boquist, is that responsive to your inquiry?
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I'm just trying to picture this. And mind you, I don't listen to much radio in Portland, but I hear about various developments and stuff everyplace else. And because the background material I'm looking at, Mr. Chair, says, you know, are affordable to households that satisfy low-income requirements. And so what's the average rent on one of these developments? I mean, we're giving a property tax exemption to an apartment that costs $145,000. I don't know what that relates to as far as the cost of buying a house out in Washington County, which I'd be more familiar with. But
Barbara, did you want to respond to that?
This tax exemption program is used mostly for rental housing projects. Some of these projects will have additional subsidies, so rents could be quite affordable. They could be affordable to households at, 30% median family income or 60% median family income. It depends what other subsidies are in the project. There's a project called the Sitka that Ed McNamara just developed in the River District. And all the units are affordable to people at 50 or 60% median family income. And so that would, for like a single person household, at 50 or 60 would be in the $600 or $700 range. However, some of these projects also include market rate rentals, so that you might have rents that go up to $900 or $1,000. It really depends project by project. What happens in the central city is there tends to be a lot of public involvement. I mean, there's, in projects. So if the tax exemption is the only subsidy, you'll have higher rents. If there's these other subsidies, other layers of subsidies, you would have lower rents. And it would depend on the location.
Barbara, I think the question is asking, Representative is asking, though, is that $1,000 a month, is that catered to the low income, low and middle income?
No. These projects are mixed income projects. There'll be, there'll be requirements that there be a certain number of. We've changed our regulations to recently say that you have to have at least 15% of your units affordable to households at or below 80% median family income. So all rental projects have to have that percentage affordable to people that are like low and moderate income. If a project has some additional subsidies, it might be affordable to people at the more people at the low end of the spectrum. It depends on the project.
If I could just add to Barbara's testimony, $1,000, I guess I would assume that'd be a larger unit. If that were a two-bedroom unit, $1,000 monthly rent would be, if you would add to that a utility allowance so they could pay their electric and gas and other utilities that a tenant normally would pay would be affordable just a little bit below 70% of median income in Portland. So a household in a two-bedroom unit is likely to be a three-person household. That would be a 70% of our area median income. That unit would be affordable to them. For a one-bedroom unit, the same level of affordability would have a rent probably in the low $800 range for, again, around 70% of median income. So the tax abatement program itself is a relatively shallow subsidy. It really doesn't allow you to achieve deep levels of affordability because it's for a limited duration, and it's not a significant amount of savings in terms of operating expenses. So with the abatement alone, we can serve units in that affordability range about 70% of median income. But as Barbara mentioned, when you layer in other subsidies, either local general funds or using some of the other subsidy programs that the federal government has provided, like the low-income housing tax credit program, then you can create mixed-income communities where you can have units down to 30% of median income, all the way up to market rate units. And then we will often see situations where the nicest units in the building at the highest income levels are actually providing internal subsidization to make a project feasible so that it can actually carry some typically smaller units, but also much more affordable ones. So you can actually have a project where on the top floors we have the best views. You've probably got people with incomes above median, up to 150% of median income, entry-level professional workers like in the downtown core often. In the lower floors, maybe some of the less desirable units, you've got people who are perhaps working in the grocery store that's in the ground floor of that unit as a butcher or something. So it creates mixed income communities that aren't a challenge for the property management companies to manage effectively and aren't unattractive to the equity investors in these projects who see those kind of communities as being viable.
As they work themselves through that and work themselves out of the federal poverty levels, do they have to move out within a short period of time?
It depends upon the nature of those layered-in subsidies. Some of them would allow you, as long as you were income eligible when you moved in, to be able to stay there for an extended period of time. Others, when you exceed income limits, then you're given a period of time within which to transition out of the project.
Like months or years?
It would probably be no longer than a year.
Okay. And let's see, Barbara, you mentioned that you have the blend of folks that you have adopted the regulations for the blend. How much of that is in statute as to how much you have to have, or is it in statute? Do you just make that rule up as you go along, city by city or area by area?
The affordability guidelines are set by the cities.
I see. Yeah. I see. So in one city it might be at 15% available to 80% poverty level. Another city it might be 100% 80% poverty level.
That's one of the benefits of the program. It allows local jurisdictions to be responsive to their electorate and the kind of objectives they're trying to achieve. You know, in Portland, our council's been very directive in terms of trying to achieve a blend of affordability for workforce housing as well as for low income, but other municipalities have different interests and they can tailor it to those interests.
Thank you, John. Representative Hass is recognized.
Thank you, Barbara. You said a minute ago that most of this is for rental housing. Does that mean that some of it's for condominiums, and how does this work for individual owners of those units?
This program can be used for condominiums. In the central city, very little use of it has been made for condominiums because there's both buyer income and price caps. And so there's been about 110 units in the central city that have been condominium units. The price cap is at 95% of the FHA mortgage limit. So a unit can only, has to stay within those limits in terms of price. And then whoever buys the unit, they have to be at 100% median family income or below.
Four projects in downtown Portland have taken advantage of this for condominium projects. And those are typically, as condos in downtown are, represent a range of incomes. It's the smaller units will be affordable to people who are first-time home buyers, and then they have larger units and units at the top of the buildings, which are very expensive. The beauty of the tax abatement program when it's applied to a condominium situation is that you could grant the abatement to a project, but the units themselves can't take advantage of it unless, A, they sell for less than 95% of the FHA mortgage limits, which I believe currently are less than $180,000. And then the household who buys the unit also has to have income less than 100% of median income. So no one who is wealthy or is purchasing an expensive dwelling unit will be able to take advantage of the abatement program. There's a binary test that it's subjected to after it's been granted that would actually render a unit eligible for participation in the program. So when the tax abatement programs are used for ownership housing, they're used typically for first-time home buyers buying less expensive units with limited incomes.
Is that responsive, Representative?
Yeah.
Please follow up.
Thank you. Assuming they meet those income tests and move into their condo, what do their property tax bills look like following that? Do they get this abatement, the individual homeowners?
Yes, the benefit of the abatement is not to the developer of a project, a condo project, who gets an abatement has relatively de minimis benefit from it. I would suggest that all it accomplishes is that it gives them a broader segment of the marketplace to market their units to. People with lower incomes can purchase those units in addition to others that might have been able to. So the abatement is really passed through the developer to the homeowner. So if that homeowner was below 100% of median income and the unit price was lower than 95% of FHA mortgage limits, which means it has to be a relatively small unit in the project, then that homeowner would benefit by having their taxes abated on the value of their improvements for the duration of the abatement. They'd still pay the taxes on the underlying land component that's part of their condo, but they wouldn't pay it on the improvements themselves. So the benefit of that is for a 10-year period of time, and most people don't actually own their homes for 10 years, as you probably know. I think 7 years is the average duration for residency in a unit. But people who are first-time home buyers can shift their disposable income from paying property taxes to be able to pay the mortgage instead. And as their income presumably will grow over time, then they'll be in a position to be able to pick up that property taxes at the end of the abatement period. So it lets them get into something, get stabilized, and then as their income grows, they're able to pay those taxes downstream.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the present median income in Portland?
For a family of four, I think it's approximately...
It's $67,900.
For a family of four.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Galizio?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, more an observation, because I think we're getting a little... I want to widen the lens a little bit or move back a little bit. What's happening in Tigard, which, of course, is in Washington County, and, again, this is at the request of Washington County, this bill... there's an attempt to revitalize downtown Tigard, and the business community in downtown is behind it. The citizenry is really very supportive. We had 90 people at a downtown task force meeting on a Saturday morning, and with the coming of commuter rail, if the folks in Washington, D.C. Do the right thing and we get that money, and this, the mixed-use development that will take place in downtown Tigard in this, you know, in a sort of a transit-oriented area, will benefit not just the people who will live in those in some of the mixed-use housing, but it will benefit the business owners in downtown. It will benefit the citizenry because downtown will be a destination. It will perhaps create jobs, which we all like to talk about. But so it's more than simply just focusing on, you know, people who are going to live in a particular housing. It has a really sort of an effect that spreads beyond. And I know for the city of Tigard, who's really working hard at this, this would be very, very useful. So just wanted to add that.
Thank you. Further comments or questions? Thank you very much for being here today. I think the only person that I had signed up, we had written testimony from instead, and that was Randy Tucker from Metro Portland. Anyone else that didn't get signed up, thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Berger?
Can I ask a further question of staff? Chair?
You bet, please.
Mary, would you go over the fiscal impact piece here? And I note that you say in the expenditure report, the fiscal year 05-07 has this at 8.4 million, and then is the revenue impact in addition because of the the sunset provision? In other words, would you explain?
The 0507 expenditure report estimate deals with all the impacts from existing projects.
Okay.
And when we estimated the effect of the additional sunset provision, we looked at the distribution of projects that came online, the historical, you know, incremental value attached to that, and we basically modeled that for the additional units that would come online, supposedly. So this is just an increment to what exists already.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Thank you very much. Further questions? If there are none, then we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 839 and open the work session on Senate Bill 839. Colleagues, we've heard 839, there's been no apparent reason to amend this bill, and so with the request of Senator Deckard and Representative Farr, it comes now Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 839 as engrossed to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
You heard the motion. Is there any discussion to the motion? Is there any objection to moving 839 as engrossed to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation? Hearing and seeing no objection to moving that, and noting that the entire committee is present, we will move Senate Bill 839 as engrossed to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll ask Representative Farr if she will carry that. If you'll notify Representative Farr, I don't see her in the room. And with that, colleagues, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 839, and we'll meet you here at evening time tomorrow. Thank you very much.